readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today we're cooking up something special, with cooking being the operative word. Increasingly, chefs are becoming celebrities, indeed superstars. Dining out is a favorite pastime, and creative cookery at home is a hobby many of us pursue. So this week, we're going to be previewing books by chefs and about chefs, from the super famous to those you may not know, but whose stories will inspire you. I hope you'll agree, this has all the ingredients for a very enjoyable show. So what's on the menu? Here we go.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Can think of no better way to start the show than with two selections by and about the queen of French cookery for Les Américaines, Julia Child. First, we have My Life in France by Julia herself with Alex Prudhomme. In her own words, here is the captivating story of Julia's years in France, where she fell in love with French food and found her true calling. Almost from the moment her ship docked in Le Havre in the fall of 1948, Julia had an awakening that changed her life. This tall, outspoken woman from Pasadena, California, who at that time did not speak a word of French and knew nothing about the country. She was soon steeped in the language, chatting with purveyors in local markets, and enrolled in the Cordon Bleu. After managing to get her cooking degree despite the school's disagreeable Madame Directrice, Julia started teaching cooking classes herself. She then teamed up with two fellow gourmets to write a book on French cooking for Americans. Throwing herself heart and soul into making the project unique and thorough, Julia suffered many painful rejections, which she shares in this book with her trademark gusto and disarming honesty. This memoir is filled with wonderful stories about the French, their world of food, and the French way of life that Julia embraced so wholeheartedly. Kimberly Farr narrates.
This is a book about some of the things I have loved most in life. My husband, Paul Child, La Belle France, and the many pleasures of cooking and eating. It is also something new for me. Rather than a collection of recipes, I've put together a series of linked autobiographical stories, mostly focused on the years 1948 through 1954, when we lived in Paris and Marseille, and also a few of our later adventures in Provence. Those early years in France were among the best of my life. They marked a crucial period of transformation in which I found my true calling, experienced an awakening of the senses, and had such fun that I hardly stopped moving long enough to catch my breath. Before I moved to France, my life had not prepared me for what I would discover there. I was raised in a comfortable, waspy, upper-middle-class family in sunny and non-intellectual Pasadena, California. My father, John McWilliams, was a conservative businessman who managed family real estate holdings. My mother, Carolyn, whom we called Caro, was a very warm and social person. But like most of her peers, she didn't spend much time in the kitchen. She occasionally sallied forth to whip up baking powder biscuits or a cheese dish or a Finnan haddie, but she was not a cook. Nor was I. As a girl, I had zero interest in the stove. I've always had a healthy appetite, especially for the wonderful meat and the fresh produce of California. But I was never encouraged to cook and just didn't see the point in it. Our family had a series of hired cooks, and they'd produce heaping portions of typical American fare. Fat roasted chicken with buttery mashed potatoes and creamed spinach, or well-marbled porterhouse steaks, or aged leg of lamb cooked medium gray, not pinky red rare as the French do, and always accompanied by brown gravy and green mint sauce. It was delicious, but not refined food. Paul, on the other hand, had been raised in Boston by a rather bohemian mother who had lived in Paris and was an excellent cook. He was a cultured man, 10 years older than I was, and by the time we met, during World War II, he had already traveled the world. Paul was a natty dresser and spoke French beautifully, and he adored good food and wine. He knew about dishes like moule marinière and bœuf bourguignon and canard à l'orange, things that seemed hopelessly exotic to my untrained ear and tongue. I was lucky to marry Paul. He was a great inspiration. His enthusiasm about wine and food helped to shape my tastes, and his encouragement saw me through discouraging moments. I would never have had my career without Paul Child. We'd first met in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, during the Second World War, and were married in September 1946. In preparation for living with a new husband on a limited government income, I decided I'd better learn how to cook. Before our wedding, I took a bride-to-be's cooking course from two English women in Los Angeles who taught me to make things like pancakes. But the first meal I ever cooked for Paul was a bit more ambitious. Brains simmered in red wine. I'm not quite sure why I picked that particular dish, other than that it sounded exotic and would be a fun way to impress my new husband. I skimmed over the recipe and figured it wouldn't be too hard to make. But the results, alas, were messy to look at and not very good to eat. In fact, the dinner was a disaster. Paul laughed it off, and we scrounged up something else that night. But deep down, I was annoyed with myself, and I grew more determined than ever to learn how to cook well. In our first year as young marrieds, we lived in Georgetown, in Washington, D.C., in a small white clapboard house on Olive Avenue. While Paul worked on mounting exhibits for the State Department, I worked as a file clerk. In the evening, I would approach the stove armed with lofty intentions, the joy of cooking, or gourmet magazine tucked under my arm, and little kitchen sense. My meals were satisfactory, but they took hours of laborious effort to produce. I'd usually plop something on the table by 10 p.m., have a few bites, and collapse into bed. Paul was unfailingly patient. But years later, he'd admit to an interviewer, her first attempts were not altogether successful.
Next, we have a title from best-selling author Jeanette Conant, A Covert Affair, Julia Child and Paul Child in the OSS. The book chronicles Julia and Paul Child's experiences as members of the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, in the Far East during World War II. Conant also details the tumultuous years when the couple was caught up in the McCarthy Red Spy Hunt in the 1950s. The eager, inexperienced 6'2" Julia springs to life in these pages, a gangly, golf-playing California girl who'd never been further abroad than Tijuana. Child joined the OSS after finding she was too tall to enlist in the Women's Army Corps or in the Navy's waves. She began her OSS career as a typist in Washington. Because of her education and experience, she soon began working directly for the head of the OSS, General William J. Donovan. In 1944, Julia was posted to Ceylon, where she met Paul Cushing Child, who was also with the OSS. She and Paul were married in September of 1946. Paul had lived in Paris prior as an artist and a poet and was known for his sophisticated palate. He introduced his wife to fine cuisine. He joined the United States Foreign Service, and in 1948, the couple moved to Paris when Paul was posted there for the State Department. This is a fascinating portrait of Julia and her husband, and the idealistic men and women recruited by the Citizen Spy Service, slapped into uniform and dispatched to wage political warfare in very remote outposts. The book is narrated by Jan Maxwell.
Paul was finally going to get his due. Perhaps he would get to run his own show, or at the very least, be allowed to pick the members of his own team. There were few things more demoralizing, in Julia's opinion, than working for people you don't admire. It was just the morale boost they both needed. 6 months earlier, Julia and Paul had been forced to leave their beloved France, and crueler still, an adorable apartment in the old port city of Marseille, because of an inane government decree that a diplomatic post in any given country could not exceed a period of 4 years. The 3 years they had spent in Paris directly after the war, followed by a 15-month stint on the southern coast, meant they had exceeded the limit. They had no choice but to pack up and go where they were told. The transfer to Bonn could not have come at a worse time. Julia had been in the midst of testing recipes for a French cookbook she was contracted to write for the Boston publisher Houghton Mifflin with two fellow gourmands she had met in Paris. She knew that the new assignment for Paul not only would take her farther from her collaborators, but would remove her from the country in whose cuisine she should be immersing herself. As difficult as it had been for her to box up her kitchen in Marseille, Julia understood that the move was infinitely harder on Paul. He had spent his formative years in France, and the language had become second nature to him, as had the internecine squabbling of the locals. The country had captured his heart long before it had taken hold of hers. Leaving Paris for Marseille had been a wrenching experience, but it was nothing compared to the jolt that Julie and Paul experienced upon learning they were being posted to Bonn. Paul was fluent in a number of languages, but German was not one of them. It was a poor use of his skills, and he was beside himself. While he had long since reconciled himself to the fact that few things in their government agency followed the dictates of logic, this yank of the chain was particularly galling. Julia could think of nothing to say to cheer him up. She had never set foot in Germany and was horrified at the thought. Her memories of World War II were too fresh for her not to dread the idea of settling in Bonn, which had temporarily replaced Berlin as the official seat of the government, because it reportedly had less historical baggage. She could only hope she would think better of the new West German capital for having escaped the brunt of the Nazi boot. "To think of living in Germany," she grimly wrote Paul's family. "Will I ever get over the imagined smell of the gas chambers and the rotting bodies of the concentration camps? Will we ever be able to learn the language in a couple of months?" Their first glimpse of their new home did nothing to lift their spirits. "Whoa, how did we get here?" Julia scribbled in her diary on October 24, 1954, the day they arrived in Bad Godesberg, a drab residential district just south of Bonn. Flush with dollars from the Marshall Plan, the entire Rhine Valley had been rapidly rebuilt as part of the country's economic and industrial redevelopment, and it was full of blocky concrete office buildings and bristling with American soldiers. Julia and Paul were dismayed to find themselves back in the familiar embrace of the U.S. military, assigned to live in a segregated, no Germans allowed, compound called Plittersdorf on the Rhine, which its unfortunate occupants had dubbed the Golden Ghetto on the Rhine. They had never cared for this part of army life, the rows of anonymous housing, streets crawling with jeeps and military policemen, and bars crowded with drunken young men in ill-fitting uniforms who wanted to be anywhere but there. Writing to her sister, Julia griped she had had enough of that meatballery during the war to last her a lifetime. Still, there were plenty of opportunities for escape. Paul's Foreign Service salary enabled them to live well, especially as the dollar was strong against the mark. Whenever possible, they fled across the river to Bonn, a picturesque university town that had been occupied by American troops toward the end of the war and had somehow managed to survive relatively unscathed, its medieval battlements and grand boulevards still redolent of old-world charm.
Readers, I'm thrilled to have a very special guest this week, author Diane Mott Davidson. Diane is the author of 16 best-selling novels featuring that fabulous foodie hero, Goldie Schultz. Goldie is a popular Colorado caterer who always seems to be stewing in a generous helping of murder and mayhem. The first book, Catering to Nobody, was published in 92, and Diane has just come out with Crunch Time, which we recently previewed. You can hear an excerpt on bookreportradio.com. Just go to the archived shows, week of May 13th and May 14th. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you, Elaine. It's good to be here.
All right. In reading your biography, I know you studied poli-sci at Wellesley, transferred to Stanford, graduated from there with a double major in art history and political science. Then you went on to receive an MA in art history from Johns Hopkins. So, the obvious question, why is Goldie a caterer and not a politician or an art historian?
Well, it's interesting because most art historians love food. And what you find when you scratch a food writer is someone who has studied art or art history. And the explanation that I have heard is that art historians go over to Europe, start to work in the museums or the libraries, and then go to some lovely French cafe and look down at all this beautiful food in front of them and say, why am I spending my time in the museum? And so that's where Goldie came from, I think, is the same sensibility.
Okay, so you love to cook? Have you ever...
Oh, yes, I do love to cook, although when my husband and I got married, the night before we got married, I was crying my eyes out saying, I can't marry you. And he said, why not? I said, I can't cook. But I did learn to cook. I watched Julia Child. She was it back in the late 60s and early 70s. There's no Food Network, Food TV. And it was wonderful. And I mentioned her so often in my early books. She wrote to me before she died thanking me, which meant a great deal to me.
Wow.
But,
so
husband was very... appreciative of all of my efforts. And when we were first married, I got a book called The I Hate to Cook Book.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was making casseroles with canned soup, and you put it in the oven at 350 for an hour. And when we finally bought a steak, because we were in Houston when we were first married, I did what you did with everything else. I put it in the oven at 350 for an hour.
Oh.
And so, but my husband ate every bite. So I learned along the way. And then when we were at Stanford, actually, we lived right down the street from Lane Publishing, which put out the Sunset Cookbooks. And I would cook for relaxation because it was fun. And so I worked my way through their cookbooks, and then I would call their test kitchens whenever I had a problem. And they were wonderful. So that gave me the confidence to learn to become a cook.
So backtracking a moment, the movie might have been Goldie and Julia instead of Julie and Julia.
Well, I really enjoyed watching Julia Child's shows because that was not the way my mother cooked. And because my mother was, you know, rice-a-roni and shake and bake chicken and that kind of thing. She didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And there was one time when she was seeing me chopping 7 different ingredients in our kitchen here, and she looked at me in puzzlement and said, you enjoy this. Yes, I do.
All right. Well, one last kind of off the track question. So Hillary Clinton lived across the hall from you at the dorm at Wellesley.
Yes.
Any stories from those days?
Well, for one thing, she was extremely nice and a hard worker, a good model. She's a bit older than I am. And she actually drafted me into the, wait for it now, the Young Republicans. I'm now a Democrat, and of course, she switched over to the Democratic Party. But I don't talk about politics.
No.
Anyway, so she drafted me into the Young Republicans, and then I was on the Student Senate, and I actually took the same law class that Hillary did that was required of poli-sci majors, and I just thought she was great.
Mm. Okay, now on to the books. Your books have amazing titles like Dying for Chocolate, The Last Supper, Sticks and Scones. How do you come up with all these?
Well, sometimes a title comes to me early on, like Prime Cut. I just knew right away that I wanted to use that as a title. But, you know, you can't copyright titles, but you do need to find out if a title has been used before and for a mystery. So, and I thought Prime Cut was going to be about cattle rustling, and then I actually spent a day with the brand inspector, they're called, out at a ranch, and I said, I can't write about this. And then found out that in modeling, many of the same metaphors are used, such as a cattle call for an audition and so on. So I kept the title Prime Cut. Now, Killer Pancake, one of our children came up with, which is about pancake makeup plus pancakes themselves. So, and Nolan had used the serial murders, which I simply couldn't believe when I used that one. So it just, sometimes it'll come to me early on, sometimes late.
Mm, and your books are sprinkled with wonderful recipes. Do you create them all?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
And test them on the family and the neighbors and, you know, the FedEx man, anyone who will taste the cookies and say, yes, this worked, no, this didn't work.
Ah. Well, your main character, Goldie, whom I love, has really evolved over the books, going from a divorced mom to marriage. So what's next for Goldie?
Well, what's next for Goldie is that I really enjoyed writing about Arch and the fencing team, because my husband was a fencer as an undergraduate at the Naval Academy. And I would go to his meets and watch him. And so, and I really enjoy writing about teenage boys, because we had three boys. We have three boys, and, you know, they all went through those teenage years, which stay etched on your memory. And so I'm writing about Goldie in this book, Arch is Turning, the next book, The Whole Enchilada is the title at this point. And I just bought a tortilla press, so I'm going to be putting in some Tex-Mex-type recipes. And Goldie will be looking into some unusual things and very deadly things happening to a group of women who were first introduced in Catering to Nobody, called Amour Anonymous, for women who love too much. And they were a support group. And then one of their members dies suddenly, and it looks as if it's just from a heart problem, but it's not. Mm-hmm. And so someone is trying to get rid of the remaining members of Amour Anonymous because they harbor a secret. Problem is, Goldie and Marla, her best friend, they don't know what the secret is. And so they have to go delving into some of these old notebooks and their memories and looking at the lives of these women to figure out what's going on.
Well, Goldie is such a rich and vivid character. Have you been approached for a TV series or maybe even movie?
Oh, well, this sounds very highfalutin, but I do have a Hollywood agent.
Okay.
But what that means is that people will look at your books and think about them. It's odd with Hollywood, at least it's odd to me, that when they buy your book or books, they buy the rights to the characters and to do whatever they want with the characters. And so far, when I've been approached, I've said no. I don't want to sell my characters.
Yeah.
And so that's been the end of any potential deal. But perhaps something will come along.
Oh. Barbara Rosenblatt who's been a guest on my show, performs many of your audio titles.
I know, she's fabulous.
She is fabulous. How involved are you with the recordings? Because your books are such a pleasure and so much fun to listen to.
Oh, I'm so glad you like them. I get fan mail for Barbara Rosenblatt. And I have met her. I met her down in Denver one time. I always request her. I think she's fabulous.
Yeah.
But I don't listen to my own audios.
You don't? Huh.
No, because I have the voice of Goldie in my head. I tried. But I just thought, no, I can't do this.
Yeah. Are you thinking to come out with a totally new character in a totally new series?
Not yet. I tried once, and with a character named Grace, who lives over in Boulder, an older woman, and my editor just loved her. So I tried to write a story from Grace's perspective, and it just wasn't there yet. But this often happens, and with writing, is that you start on something and it's not quite there yet, so you have to wait for it to blossom in your subconscious, and then you can write about it. But I did get a cookbook deal, and so I'll be working on the whole idea of the cookbook, and then we'll see.
Oh, okay. Last question. For those who aren't really familiar with your titles, do you have a favorite that you would send people to listen to first?
To listen to?
Yeah. Or read.
Well, a lot of people, the first book in the series is Catering to Nobody, and I do believe that Barbara Rosenblatt has done a version of that.
Yes.
A lot of people start with Dying for Chocolate, and because it introduces all the characters who run through all the books, and that's the second book in the series. So I would say either one of those to start with would be great.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Diane. I love
thank
your
you.
Books, and I'm always ready for the next one. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, Elaine, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All righty. Bye.
Bye.
As Diane suggests, if you're not familiar with her entertaining series, it's best to be introduced to her crazy cast of characters in Catering to Nobody, her first novel. We'll preview that now for you as, shall we say, an amuse-bouche. The heroine of this series, Goldie Bear, is a recent divorcee who's made a home for herself and her young son in Aspen Valley, Colorado. While her business, Goldilocks Catering, is not making her millions, it does pay the bills. But then, at a funeral buffet Goldie is catered, a mourner is felled by rat poison. The police quickly close her business. Now it's up to Goldie to find the rat who has tainted her food and her reputation. Diane Mott Davidson whips up a spicy mixture of cooks and crooks, and veteran narrator Barbara Rosenblatt brilliantly conveys Goldie's intelligence, wit, and energy. As the mystery unfolds, you'll also be treated to some delectable recipes. Let's listen.
I stared grimly at the calendar. Lots of parties between Halloween and Christmas. That was the ticket to financial security. Problem number three, after short notice and money, was getting all the supplies for a job. My food supplier was doing an extra run for me because she, too, had known the financial strains of single motherhood. Her truck was supposed to be rumbling up from Denver right now, bringing a salmon and out-of-season asparagus and strawberries. After she delivered them, she'd give me a lecture on going out. She'd say, "It's not that tough to have fun." But tough was like a roll in the microwave. I didn't have time for a harangue about my social life, because in addition to needing the supplies, I'd just used the last of the honey to make the rolls. This meant the muffins were on hold. The local honey supplier was a handsome fellow named Pomeroy, lusted after by every unattached woman in the county, a fact my supplier usually did not fail to mention. Unfortunately, Pomeroy had said he wouldn't be able to get over for a while to resupply my stock. The unusually warm weather had brought out a predator that had raided one of the hives, and he had his hands full. Of what? I had wanted to say, but hadn't. Sugar would do for the muffins. The phone rang. "Goldilocks Catering," I said into the receiver. "Where everything is just..." "Spare me the greeting, Goldie," came the voice of Alicia, my supplier. "I called Northwest Seafood. Fish is all yours." "You're great," she mm-hmmed, and then said nothing. I said, "What is it? How well did you know this Laura?" She was Arch's teacher for a couple of grades. "Young? Early 40s, I said. "She acted young." I paused. "I knew her." She grunted and said she'd be up in an hour. I opened the refrigerator, a walk-in needed for the business. John Richard Corman, my ex-husband, had found the cost of this item ridiculous. Ditto the van, and the required new sinks and shelves to store food above insect level. Other purchases out of my $60,000 divorce settlement had included a 6-burner stove, extra oven and freezer, and enough cooking equipment to outfit Sears. Retrofitting our old house off Aspen Meadows Main Street hadn't been terribly difficult. what had been difficult was hanging up on John Richard's alternately shrieking and pleading voice, and then finally getting the locks changed when he'd shown up repeatedly to do one of two things. At first, even though we were separated, he would try to seduce me. Sometimes successfully, I was ashamed to admit. Or he would start a fight to demonstrate his opposition to my financial independence. And by demonstrate, I don't mean like Gandhi. In the walk-in, I reached for the butter, eggs, and cream. I backed out and whacked the door with my foot, then regarded my balancing act in the mirror-black surface. Blonde, curly hair. Freckles on a face unbruised for 3 years. Brown eyes. These stared back at me, saying, "Don't think about it now, just cook." At 30, I was doing okay. Single, but with good friends. And only slightly pudgy from all the fancy cooking that made the living for Arch and me.
Okay, since we're cooking up some culinary favorites you may have missed, here's one from a chef I love. Anthony Bourdain. If you haven't read his Kitchen Confidential, you need to, for two reasons. One, it's hilarious. Two, you need to know why, among other dining out tips, you must never order fish on a Monday. From his lowly position as a dishwasher in a honky-tonk fish restaurant in Provincetown, to the kitchen of the Rainbow Room atop Rockefeller Center, and then on to TV stardom and No Reservations, Bourdain opens the kitchen door. And when you look in, you'll see it's quite a world back there. Kitchen Confidential, narrated by the lovingly irascible Mr. Bourdain, is a must-read for anyone who dines out and who enjoys one great story. By the way, we previewed Bourdain's newest title, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, last year. You can listen to that excerpt by going to my website, bookreportradio.com, and clicking on Archived Shows, October 2010.
Of course, there's every possibility this book could finish me in the business. There will be horror stories. Heavy drinking, drugs, screwing in the dry goods area, unappetizing revelations about bad food handling and unsavory industry-wide practices. Talking about why you probably shouldn't order fish on a Monday, why those who favor well done get the scrapings from the bottom of the barrel, and why seafood frittata is not a wise brunch selection won't make me any more popular with potential future employers. My naked contempt for vegetarians, sauce on ciders, the lactose intolerant, and the cooking of the Ewok-like Emeril Lagasse is not going to get me my own show on the Food Network. I don't think I'll be going on ski weekends with Andre Soltner anytime soon or getting a back rub from that hunky Bobby Flay. Eric Repair won't be calling me for ideas on tomorrow's fish special. But I'm simply not going to deceive anybody about the life as I've seen it. It's all here. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
A captivating memoir, The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen, by Jacques Pepin, tells the story of the man whom Julia Child called the best chef in America. He rose from a frightened apprentice in an old-world kitchen to an Emmy Award-winning superstar who taught millions of Americans how to cook. As a homesick 6-year-old boy in war-ravaged France, Jacques worked on a farm in exchange for food, dodging bombs and bearing witness as German soldiers captured his father, a resistance fighter. Soon Jacques was caught up in the hurly-burly action of his mother's café, where he proved a natural. He endured a trial by fire, literally, and worked his way up the ladder in France's most famous restaurant. He also became the personal chef to Charles de Gaulle. When Pepin came to America, he fell in with a group of as-yet unknown food lovers, including Craig Claiborne, James Beard, and Julia Child. The master of the American art of reinvention, Jacques went on to earn a graduate degree from Columbia, turned down a job as JFK's chef to work at Howard Johnson's. Then, after a near-fatal car accident, he switched careers to become a charismatic leader in the American culinary revolution. The title is narrated by Michel Chevalier.
In towns and cities, food was always scarce in France during the Second World War. In the countryside, farmers may not have had two sous to rub together, but gardens produced vegetables, corn grew in fields. Pigs became fat, chickens laid eggs, and cows gave milk that was turned into cream, butter, and cheese. Out of kindness, rural folk would take in the children of townspeople, giving room and board in exchange for chores. Although hearty, the food at the farms was simple and straightforward, coarse, and without variety. A gratin of squash with cream, homemade cheeses, roasted or boiled potatoes, and cured pork held in barrels from the previous year were the most common dishes. Occasionally, on Sundays, farm families ate roast chicken or rabbit, followed by plum or apple tarts. Nothing fancy, but compared to what we ate in town, this was feasting. In the fall, the children would return home tanner, stronger, and fatter. The big day came. Maman prepared a picnic lunch. I hopped into a trailer that she towed behind her bike, and together we set off through a landscape of hills, valleys, vineyards, fields, and roadsides shaded by the leafy branches of plane trees. Late that afternoon, we arrived in Foissia, a hamlet in the center of the rich agricultural region of La Bresse. We pulled into the courtyard of a farmhouse identical to any of 100 Mama had already pedaled past. It was fashioned from blonde colored mud and round stones, and had a red tile roof, plain, except for being topped by the ornate and vaguely Middle Eastern-style Saracen chimney. Just as I had imagined, chickens, ducks, and a pair of majestic geese squabbled, quacked, and honked in the courtyard, and a stinky mud-caked pig grunted in one corner. It was exciting and a bit scary to be that close to real farm animals. The farmer's wife greeted us, ruffling my hair and cooing. It was a surprising sound given its source, the tallest, roughest-looking, and most powerfully built woman I had ever laid eyes on. She had a bright red face and wore the traditional peasant's bonnet. While she and my mother went into the house, the farmer, a big man with a great mustache that curled up at the corners, took me to the barn, which was even more exhilarating than the courtyard. Although I had seen plenty of cows in my day, I had never stood close to one. In that shadowy building, where the sweet scent of hay and raw milk mingled with the acidity of manure and urine, a dozen broad wet noses turned in my direction.
Nicole Moens, author of The Last Chinese Chef, is a food writer who spent 18 years traveling to China. So it's fair to say when this girl writes about a food writer who spends weeks in China, she is up to the task. In fact, Chinese food is the thread that holds this story together. In this very sensual novel, the author takes readers inside the hidden world of elite cuisine in modern China. It's the story of an American food writer in Beijing. When recently widowed Maggie McElroy is called to China to settle a claim against her late husband's estate, she is blindsided by the discovery that he may have led a double life. Since work is all that will keep her sane, her magazine editor assigns her to profile Sam, a half-Chinese American who is the last in the line of gifted chefs tracing back to the Imperial Palace. As she watches Sam gear up for China's Olympic culinary competition by planning the banquet of a lifetime, she begins to see past the cuisine's artistry to glimpse it as a coherent expression of Chinese civilization. It is here, amid lessons of tradition, obligation, and human connection, that she finds the secret ingredient that may yet heal her heart. The book is performed by Elizabeth Rogers and James Chen.
On the September evening that marked the beginning of these events, she was leaving the boat to go out and find a place to eat dinner. It was a few days after her 40th birthday, which she'd slid past with careful avoidance. She found the parking lot empty, punctuated only by the cries of gulls. As she reached her car, she heard her phone ringing. The sound was muffled. It was deep in her bag. Living on the boat kept her bag overloaded, a small price to pay. She dug, following the green light that shimmered with each ring. She didn't answer her phone that often, but she always checked it. There were some calls, from work, from her best friend, Sunny, from her mother, which she never failed to pick up. When she looked at the screen, she felt her brows draw together. This was not a caller she recognized. It was a long string of numbers. She clicked it. Hello? Maggie? This is Carrie James, from Beijing. Do you remember me? Yes. She went slack with surprise. Matt's law firm kept an office in Beijing, and Carrie was one of its full-time attorneys. Matt had flown over there more than a few times on business. Maggie'd even gone with him once, 3 years before. She'd met Carrie, tall, elegant, faintly dissipated. Matt had said he was a gifted negotiator. I remember. Some year, he said, his manner disintegrating slightly. You're telling me. She unlocked the car and climbed in. Are you all right? I'm surviving. What was this about? Everything had been over months ago with the firm, even the kindness calls, even the check-ins from Matt's closest friends here in the L.A. office. She hadn't heard from any of them lately. I'm calling, actually, because I've come across something. I really should have seen it before. Unfortunately, I didn't. It's a legal filing here in China. It concerns Matt. Matt? Yes, Carrie said. It's a claim. What do you mean? What kind? Carrie drew a breath. She could feel him teetering. I was hoping there was a chance you might know, he said. Know what? Carrie, what kind of claim? Paternity, he said. She sat for a long moment. A bell seemed to drop around her, cutting out all sound. She stared through her sea-scummed windshield at the line of palms, the bike path, the mottled sand. So this person is saying she has his child. So I guess you didn't know anything about this. She swallowed. No, I did not. Did you? Did you know about a child? No, he said firmly. Nothing. So what do you think this is? I don't know, honestly, but I do know one thing. You can't ignore it. It's serious. A claim has been filed. Under the new Children's Rights Treaty, it can be decided right here in China, in a way that's binding on you, and it's going to be decided soon. She heard him turning pages. In a little less than 3 weeks. Then what? Then if the person who filed the claim wins, they get a share of his estate. Excluding the house, of course, the principal residence.
From the chef of the headline-grabbing New York restaurant Prune comes a delicious memoir from Chef Gabrielle Hamilton. Blood, Bones, and Butter follows an unconventional journey through the many kitchens Hamilton inhabited through the years. The rural kitchen of her childhood, the kitchens of France, Greece, and Turkey, and the soulless catering factories that helped pay the rent. Having gone to graduate school for creative writing, Hamilton describes her life story not only as a chef, but as a writer. As a bonus, she narrates the audiobook herself with the feeling and attachment one expects from someone analyzing her own life. With each chapter, it becomes obvious Hamilton has managed not only to survive, but actually thrive in the financially risky and still, sadly, machismo-dominated food service industry. Beginning with her youth as a high school dropout abandoned by a hippie father, Hamilton relied on experiences in the family kitchen to get hired as a waitress and line cook at a variety of diners. Later, she traveled the world more on the strength of her wits than her wallet. She learned about world cuisine from anybody willing to teach her. As she finds herself increasingly embedded in the world of food, she is startled to realize that it has become her true passion. There is something here for everyone to enjoy. Aspiring chefs will be relieved to know that some fulfilling work-life balance is possible. foodies will delight in the comparison of regional Italian cuisine with its woefully inadequate American counterpart. And, of course, scrappy women everywhere who always manage to land on their feet will appreciate this unflinching testimony to the importance of having strength of character and a willingness to go your own way.
We spent all of our time out of doors in mud suits, snow suits, or bare feet, depending on the weather. Even in nature, running around in the benign woods and hedges and streams, diving in and out of tall grasses and brambles, playing a nighttime game that involved dodging the oncoming headlights of an approaching occasional car, bombing the red shale rocks down into the stream from the narrow bridge near our driveway to watch them shatter, we found rough and not innocent pastimes. We trespassed, drag-raced, smoked, burgled, and vandalized. We got ringworm, broken bones, tetanus, concussion, stitches, and ivy poisoning. My parents seemed incredibly special and outrageously handsome to me then. I could not have boasted of them more or said my name, first and last together, more proudly to show how it directly linked me to them. I loved that our mother was French and that she had given me that heritage in my very name. I loved telling people that she had been a ballet dancer at the Met in New York City when she married my father. I loved being able to spell her long French name, M-A-D-E-L-E-I-N-E, which had exactly as many letters in it as my own. My mother wore the sexy black cat-eye eyeliner of the era, like Audrey Hepburn and Sophia Loren, and I remember the smell of the sulfur every morning as she lit a match to warm the tip of her black wax pencil. She pinned her dark hair back into a tight, neat twist every morning, and then spent the day in a good skirt, high heels, and an apron that I have never seen her without in 40 years. She lived in our kitchen, ruled the house with an oily wooden spoon in her hand, and forced us all to eat dark, briny, wrinkled olives, small birds we would have liked as pets, and cheeses that looked like they might well bear Legionnaire's disease. Her kitchen, over 30 years ago, long before it was common, had a two-bin stainless steel restaurant sink and a six-burner Garland stove. Her burnt orange Le Creuset pots and casseroles, scuffed and blackened, were constantly at work on the back three burners, cooking things with tails, claws, and marrow-filled bones. Whatever was budgeted from our dad's sporadic and mercurial artist's income, that she was stewing and braising and simmering to feed our family of seven. Our kitchen table was a big round piece of butcher block where we both ate and prepared casual meals. My mother knew how to get everything comestible from a shin or neck of some animal, how to use a knife, how to cure a cast iron pan. She taught us to articulate the S in salade niçoise and the soup vichyssoise so that we wouldn't sound like other Americans who didn't know that the vowel E after the consonant S in French means that you say the S out loud. And yet I remember the lamb roast as my father's party. I recall it was really his gig. With an art degree from Rhode Island School of Design on his office wall, two union cards, stagehands and scenic artists in his wallet, five able-bodied children, a French wife, and a photograph torn from a magazine of two Yugoslav guys roasting a lamb over a pit, he created a legendary party, a feast that almost 200 people came to every year from as far away as the townhouses of New York City and as near as our local elementary school. My dad could not cook at all. He was then a set designer for theatrical and trade shows, and he had a design and build studio in Lambertville, the town where he himself had grown up, the town where his own father had been the local country doctor. We kids were forever running into people who'd say, "Your granddaddy delivered all three of my sons," or, "Your granddaddy drove a Cadillac," one of the very few cars at that time in Lambertville.
In 2007, Chef Grant Eckerts seemingly had it made. He'd been named one of the best new chefs in America by Food & Wine in 2002, received the James Beard Foundation Rising Star Chef of the Year Award in 2003, and in 2005, he and Nick Kokonis opened Alinea, which was named Best Restaurant in America by Gourmet Magazine. Then, positioned firmly in the world's culinary spotlight, he was diagnosed with stage 4 squamous cell carcinoma, tongue cancer. In Life on the Line, a chef's story of chasing greatness, facing death, and redefining the way we eat, Akitz and Nick Kokonis tell a gripping tale. His prognosis was grim. Doctors agreed the only course of action was to remove the cancerous tissue, including his entire tongue. Desperate to preserve his quality of life, Grant undertook an alternative treatment of aggressive chemotherapy and radiation. But the choice came at a big cost. Skin peeled inside his mouth and throat, he rapidly lost weight, and most alarmingly, Grant lost his sense of taste. Tapping into discipline, passion, and focus of being a chef, Grant trained his chefs to mimic his palate. He learned how to cook with his other senses. 5 months later, Grant was declared cancer-free, and just a few months later, he received the James Beard Foundation Outstanding Chef in America Award. Life on the Line tells the story of a culinary trailblazer's love affair with cooking. It is also a book about survival, about nurturing creativity, and about profound friendship. Johnny Heller narrates.
My lips didn't always go where I intended them to, and my speech sounded slurred and distorted. Like eating, speaking was arduous. None of this was a good setup for a public appearance, and it got off to an awkward start. When I arrived at Lincoln Center, many of the country's great chefs tried to avoid me. No one approached me to say hello. I walked through the crowd and felt like a leper. At that time, it did not occur to me that they were trying to act normal, to not have to ask, "How are you doing?" The only good news at this point was that I was reasonably certain I would not win. Nick Kokonis, my business partner, put my chances as only a good friend could. "You have no chance of winning. Dan Barber is going to kick your scrawny ass. He is a great chef, he's been at it longer, and he's from New York. That is a killer combo. And he cooks real food. You're screwed." We had a good laugh at that, but it was exactly what we both thought. I grabbed a glass of champagne as a prop and stood in a corner with my girlfriend Heather. Although I considered leaving, she convinced me to go inside and sit down. I slumped down in my seat and the awards began. These ceremonies tend to drag on. An outstanding chef was the very last award to be given. Finally, Kim Cattrall slinked on stage to announce the last award of the evening. I perked up momentarily, smiled when my name was read as a nominee, and settled back into my chair. Then the announcement. "The Outstanding Chef in America for 2008 is Grant Akitz." I was stunned. Suddenly, I was on stage and the crowd stood cheering. The words, unprepared, tumbled out of me. Rather than thank specific people who obviously I need to, but in fact probably know who they are, I want to tell a quick story instead if I could. In 1996, I started at the French Laundry as a commis. I was 22 years old, and I was in awe. I walked into that restaurant, and I saw a gentleman that ultimately would become my mentor and, at this point, even though it feels a little awkward to say, a great friend. What struck me about the restaurant was the push. I had never seen it before in my life. I had never experienced the discipline, the dedication, the intensity, the tenacity, and the drive that both the chef and all of the cooks possessed. I pulled that in, thinking it was going to make me a good cook and ultimately a great chef. What I didn't know was that it was actually going to save my life. That drive, that tenacity, that dedication that I took in at that restaurant, it became a part of who I am. 10 years later, 12 years later, it helped me get through a pretty ridiculous battle. I think that everybody in the room can be proud of that because everybody can relate to how cooking, in one way or another, has not only influenced their professional career but also their lives. Also, I need to thank everybody in this room for the tremendous amount of support that I received in this last year. I had emails, countless phone calls, letters, packages, offers from chefs that I consider mentors, friends, colleagues, and visionaries, to help in any way that they possibly could at a time when I needed it.
Fiction editor at The New Yorker, Bill Buford brings a sharp, exuberant, close-up account of his headlong plunge into life of a professional cook in Heat. Expanding on his James Beard award-winning New Yorker article, Bill Buford gives us a richly evocative chronicle of his experience as a slave to Mario Batali in the kitchen of Batali's three-star New York restaurant, Babbo. In a fast-paced, candid narrative, Buford describes three frenetic years of trial and error, disappointments and triumph, his relationship with the larger-than-life Batali, whose story he learns as their friendship grows through kitchen encounters and after-work all-nighters. Heat is a marvelous hybrid, a memoir of Buford's kitchen adventure, the story of Batali's amazing rise to culinary and extra culinary fame, a dazzling behind-the-scenes look at a famous restaurant, and an illuminating exploration of why food matters. It's read by Michael Kramer.
Batali was an impressively dedicated drinker. He mentioned in passing that on trips to Italy made with his Babbo co-owner, Joe Bastianich, the two of them had been known to put away a case of wine during an evening meal. And while I don't think that any of us drank anything like that, we were by now very thirsty. The lardo, the salt, the human heat of so much jollity. And, cheered on, found ourselves knocking back more and more. I don't know. I don't really remember. There were also the grappa and the nocino, and one of my last images is of Batali at 3 in the morning, a stoutly round man with his back dangerously arched, his eyes closed, a long red ponytail swinging rhythmically behind him, an unlit cigarette dangling from his mouth, his red Converse high tops pounding the floor, playing air guitar to Neil Young's Southern Man. Batali was 41, and I remember thinking it had been a long time since I'd seen a grown man play air guitar. He then found the soundtrack for Buena Vista Social Club, tried to salsa with one of the women guests, who promptly fell over a sofa, moved on to her boyfriend, who was unresponsive, put on a Tom Waits CD instead, and sang along as he washed the dishes and swept the floor. He reminded me of an arrangement we'd made for the next day. When I'd invited Batali to dinner, he'd reciprocated by asking me to join him at a New York Giants football game, tickets courtesy of the commissioner of the NFL, who had just eaten at Babbo, and then disappeared with three of my friends, assuring them that, with his back-of-the-hand knowledge of downtown establishments open until 5, he'd find a place to continue the evening. They ended up at Mary Lou's in the village. In Batali's description, a wise guy joint where you can get anything at any time of night and none of it good. It was daylight when Batali got home. I learned this from his building superintendent the next morning as the two of us tried to get Batali to wake up. The commissioner's driver was waiting outside. When Batali finally appeared, 45 minutes later, he was momentarily perplexed, standing in the doorway of his apartment in his underwear and wondering why I was there too. Batali has a remarkable girth, and it was startling to see him clad so. Then, in minutes, he transformed himself into what I would come to know as the Batali look. The shorts, the clogs, the wraparound sunglasses, the red hair pulled back into its ponytail. One moment, a rotund Clark Kent in his underpants, the next, Molto Mario, the clever, many-layered name of his cooking television program, which, in one of its senses, literally means Very Mario.
You found some tempting titles. Remember to check out my website, bookreportradio.com, for a complete smorgasbord of the summer's best books. Is there a book you've been wondering about? If you'd like me to preview it, just send me a note. Go to bookreportradio.com and click on the Reader's Corner, or simply send an email to elaine@bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining in our literary culinary tour, and tune in a week for the next chapter of The Book Report.